This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
It's time to get intimate with Checkpoint Intimates.
Yes, you have stumbled across another episode of Checkpoint Intimates. We are a weekly gaming podcast where two members of the Checkpoint team go one-on-one and get intimate on a particular gaming topic. My name is Elliot, and this week I'm joined by a man whose name appears to alternate between Jack and Cringe.
I'm in a cringe mood at the moment. So
it's cringe!
Yeah, that's what it is right now. hello,
it's When's the Jack mood?
I think I started doing that when I came to Checkpoint because I was like, I need something of a normal name. Like, because no one on the Checkpoint team knew me, right? It was you and Luke and then not much beyond that. So I was like, well, I'm a well-adjusted human being. I promise. That's wrong about half the time. It's fine. But I was like, yeah, let's just go with a normal goddamn name. And now I'm like, no, revert to cringe. Because that's what I always would post when I was doing stuff with Zed Games in Brisbane. So.
I think that makes sense. You got to stick to your identity. You've built this up. Imagine if Hex was no longer Hex. You'd be like, whoa.
Well, I mean, she kind of isn't. I mean that's kind of...
that's kind bad of, example.
Yeah. But no, I kind of enjoy cringe because it's also like... you're not sure if it's a sort of masculine or feminine. It's a very gender neutral sort of... Because you just have no... There's no precedence for like...
Very androgynous,
sort of,
very
what
cool.
What sort of name? Androgynous. I always forget that
so
word.
So hip.
Yeah. So I like kind of... throwing people like that. Like, I put in gender-neutral pronouns into my essays and throw my, like, lecturers on who I'm talking about. And I'm like, ugh, I probably should fix that, but...
no, that's great. You stick to that.
In every other context, it is very, very, at least, entertaining. So
that's good.
I do
I mean,
where I can.
We're not here to talk too much about you, even though that was incredibly entertaining.
Back to me, now away from me, yeah.
Now away from you, because I also wanted to talk about E3 2020, or... the lack thereof this year, what might replace it, what the future looks like for the whole E3 brand. And this is kind of a big topic because this starts way back.
Well, I mean, it's also, it's big for E3, but I think it's also big for the industry, right? Like E3, it has in a way defined what the industry is doing, what we want to be doing, how we want to be seen. And so E3 has, I think, had a very big... like, they've had the responsibility of basically carrying the industry at times. That's not something to be taken lightly. As fun as it is to, like, bash on different corporations or whatever else, and we'll get into why people have been over the last few years.
And we'll bash them later, yeah.
Well, I mean, I think there is some cause for critique from the press specifically because of the way that the people who run E3, ESA, the entertainment... what is the ESA?
Software Association.
There you go. They have basically had some stumbles over the last 5 years or so. Well, I mean, over the last 10 years at least.
Well, should we get into that? Like, what is the history of E3? Like, obviously this came about and it's very different now to what it used to be. But in the last, 5 years, they've really been... kind of struggling a bit, haven't they?
I think it depends on who you ask. Like, the kind of industry, the media, right? The games media, I feel like, has always been the key sort of stakeholder in E3, right? Like, the E3 exists for the media to go there. There is a lot that happens at E3 behind closed doors with regards to publishing and developing and all of those stakeholders, but that isn't necessarily the public face of E3, right? It's the media face that people see and people value. And so the ESA, basically moving away from giving this sort of status, I think, to the media when they started opening to the public in 2016, that sort of started this sort of frustration and delegitimization of E3 within the games sort of convention circuit.
Yeah, what were some of those frustrations? I know you know them pretty well. We may as well not tiptoe around it.
Not that many. Well, I mean, at the time, like, I mean, we're talking 2016. Like, that far back was... It was a frustration of people... the ESA basically bringing in normies, right? Like, you don't want to bring in public, like, non-business people to what has traditionally been a business-centric, and that is the business of the media-centric event. Mm-hmm. And so that was where it sort of, that frustration started. I think more recently, I think it was 2019 or 2018, there was like a doxing of like media, basically. So there was a leak of information where the media have to provide their credentials and their information to the ESA to be able to get into E3. That's kind of typical. In the case of E3, it was a few years ago, there was a leak from the ESA of all of that private information, including, I think, at least email addresses and mobile numbers. There may have been some home addresses, all of that kind of stuff. And that, you know, especially within the media, you don't necessarily want that information going public because you rely on these means of communication and having, like, some sort of safety in your own goddamn house. Like, if people can just rock up to your apartment building and be like, I'm going to come into your house, you're like, I don't feel safe. That's not a thing that I want to experience. And so that was one of the more recent, I think, scandals, if you want to call it that, around E3.
Yeah, and it was just piling on top of some disdain that was already kind of generating for the ESA. And I think they've also been struggling in a way to make E3 as relevant as it used to be in a world that is moving more digital. You know, obviously we have some publishers who are totally fine not being at E3 anymore. Sony have made that very apparent in the last couple of years, where they're like, well, we don't need E3. Even in a year we're launching a console, we don't need E3. We plan to do our own things. And it becomes a scary time for the ESA when, you know, they're not a PAX where it's all about the public. And all of a sudden, all these publishers are pulling out. And the other kind of tendril of this is the media, who are kind of angry at us. Oh no, what is really happening to E3?
Yeah,
and obviously, I mean, then coronavirus hit and bam.
Yeah, so like I think that frustration around the E3 basically bringing in public, the public, right? It seemed to suggest that there wasn't as much business, there wasn't as much relevance around E3. And so bringing in the public was done in an effort to boost the relevance of E3 within the convention circuit. You know, looking at something like, you know, the PAXs around the world or a Gamescom, which is the biggest, as far as attendance numbers, gaming conventions in the world, E3 was always, oh, we have the biggest announcements, we have all the big players, like, that's why you come here. And in more recent years, we've seen, well, I mean, as far back as, God, how long has Nintendo been doing Nintendo Directs for? Let's find out. I love Google.
A while, probably.
Yeah, so, yeah. Like, that sort of started this this process of publishers and hardware manufacturers seeing that there are opportunities to market their games and to integrate that into their whole marketing campaign, because that's how these big companies operate. They were able to do that on their own terms. And I think, quite importantly as well, not have to give the LA Convention Center, give the ESA that mad amount of cash to be able to take up that space, right? Like, whether that was on the convention floor or whether it was where, you know, the big announcements are made within a press conference, those things cost money, right? And sometimes companies choose to commit, like in the case of Bethesda a few years ago. They had a horrendous press conference. I think it was the Bethesda Land, the first one, conference. I remember writing an article for that on New Game Plus. It was bad. And that was basically happening because the year prior was an all right press conference. The year following was also okay. But that year they were like, well, we're locked into this contract, I guess we better rock up with something, and it was not very good. So yeah, it costs a lot of money to be able to integrate that into the publisher's marketing campaigns. And so where publishers have an opportunity to kind of break with that and potentially save money or find more efficient sort of investment strategies in that marketing campaign, it's understandable as to why they might pursue that.
Yeah, and look, I think tonally, obviously, this podcast is going to be quite negative on E3 just because of the news we have to share. But with that said, I actually really like E3. I like being able to even just stream in and watch live and have a bombardment of video game announcements. It's kind of a really crazy time, and it's a really fun time. And maybe that's because, you know, I haven't had to endure enough E3s where it's become tiresome so far. For me, it's still really entertaining. It is disappointing not to have E3 2020 happening this year. Do you feel the same way?
Well, I think that it's about, like, what E3 represents, I think. it's frustrating, I think, amongst the sort of pandemic and a lot of countries shutting down, to have to come to terms with another aspect of, you know, life as normal basically being taken away. I think that that's an important sort of first part of this. I think that the big announcements and sort of how those marketing campaigns and how the timeline of development looks, that still is going to occur. It might not necessarily occur, you know, quite under one roof, right? But because of how the games industry typically bunches releases, you know, a few months before the holiday season, I think that it makes sense for developers, for publishers as well, to place a lot of the big reveals, right, where they have an opportunity to leak out bits of information, but still maintain this sort of air of, like, this game is in demand, information about this game is very highly sought after. Giving that time frame between a June announce date, let's say, and maybe a September, October, November release date still plays into that traditional rollout of marketing and media and press impressions, all of that. So I think that, sure, the event not being there, some journalists honestly will kind of like that not happening, because, you know, their interest in the ESA not being as useless, you know, in their eyes, right? But I think that people saying, oh no, E3 is not going to be around, like, we're not going to have all of these big announcements, it's like, well, there are a lot of digital events that are happening, right? Like, you look at Nintendo Direct over the last few years, they have been smashing it. They've been, like, honestly taking over news cycles in a lot of cases with just dropping a Nintendo Direct. Like, oh, tomorrow we're going to have a Direct at, like, 9 a.m. And press, like, what? And then it's just, like, big release, big release, big release. Here's 13 indies. Go and play 6 of them. They're out now on the eShop. that sort of precedent that the Nintendo Direct brought in from as early as 2011, right? Like, we're seeing more companies.
Oh, the research was done.
Yeah,
very Google, impressed. Man, we didn't even hear any clicking or clacking.
No. Low profile keyboard, man. It's the opposite of the PCMR approach.
Yeah, yeah. If you heard me trying to do some research during this recording.
So, like, they've been doing it as far back as 2011. The PlayStation State of Play announcements, while they're obviously not as highly valued, like, the announcements that they make are not as sort of these big blockbuster, like, announcements. Like, they're about, you know, big blockbuster games, but they're not, oh, we're announcing The Last of Us 2 through a PlayStation State of Play. They would look to a bigger PlayStation Experience event. They might look to an E3. They might look to integrate that into some other sort of bigger conventions where you can sort of piggyback and in a way sort of take over a lot of, again, that news cycle by throwing in your announcement amongst sort of this atmosphere of gaming fever, you know, if you will.
So there
are plenty of sort of situations like that. As much as E3 itself won't be happening, we're still going to be seeing plenty of announcements around June and July, I think.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. Obviously, kind of these digital events are going to be a big part of the future moving forward for all of these game publishers, but there is still some relevancy to that physical space because, A, you get all the media and journos in there alongside the developers and publishers, so you're able to conduct these interviews and have these chats and do this networking and also play these games as well alongside their announcement often. So E3 definitely has a big use for the industry, but once again, there are other events like GDC and PAX and Tokyo Game Show and everything like that where all of those things can also happen, but it felt like E3 was the biggest. It was the biggest hub. Everybody went to E3, and not having that will still leave a bit of a stain on the kind of gaming industry as a whole. It is interesting looking at the history of E3 just in the lead up to E3 2020, right? Even before all of this global pandemic and stuff happened, there was still a lot of questions about what E3 2020 will be, and I don't know how much of this you're aware of, but they lost their show host and their show floor creative team before they announced this that E3 2020 won't happen, and before all of this stuff with the coronavirus pandemic happened as well. And a lot of the kind of statements that were coming out were basically, if you read between the lines, or at least from my perspective, it sounded like the ESA was trying to control a lot of things that were happening, and they weren't letting these entities that were there to try to make the best E3 they could do, they weren't allowing those entities to shine or really do anything impactful. And so there was obviously tension going on between the ESA and these people they were trying to work with. And then it all obviously came crumbling down. And it makes you wonder, like, what is E3 2021? We already know they've said there's no 2020. It's not even an online thing. That's not happening at all. So the next E3 will be in 2021. What is that going to be? Do they have to do a massive kind of backpedal or some kind of revolutionary advancement to make themselves relevant again? What do you perceive?
I think that... I mean, first of all, I think it's probably worth pointing out that we, as much as there's, you know, they're saying we'll be back in 2021.
We don't know.
There's no guarantee that we won't see the level of, I mean, we probably will see a decrease in how restrictive travel is and how restrictive our actions can be and what businesses can operate. But the reality is, like, some of that will still be in place potentially by next June. That's a long way away, and it's a lot for people to think about, especially, you know, in the middle of Easter when it's normal to travel and see family and all the rest of it. But that's first of all there. So the ESA will have to potentially navigate that as well, because it's not only a practicality thing, right, of, oh, well, can you get here? It's a matter of, you know, should you get here? The reason why a lot of these events, well, not the reason, but part of the PR around why these events might be stopping in advance, right, is because A, governments might be saying you can't have gatherings of more than 10 people. Sure, mm-hmm. There's a legality argument to be made there. But even if that wasn't there, then companies basically saying, oh yeah, we endorse, right, like the mass gathering of people that could potentially spread disease like that. It's not a good look from a PR perspective. It's not a good look where a company is to be seen as not valuing the people that make the events, the games, all of that kind of happen, right? A good example of that is this sort of frustration around the Queensland, I think, local government elections, right? That happened in the middle of these heightened restrictions. So I think that it'll be interesting to see how the ESA responds to that next year. I think E3 will still have relevance because of the way that it sustains the media industry more broadly, right? Like, indie developers can be thought of as losing out in a world with no E3, right? Because they don't have this monumental platform that some games can take advantage of and really, you know, skyrocket in their popularity and their knowledge and all of that, right, ahead of releasing. Mm-hmm. But the media really, really sort of thrives on these in-person events, and it's indeed where a lot of their business is made. They see an increase in the traffic to their website. They see an increase in, you know, ad revenue on these sites, and I imagine that there would be a lot of integrated campaigns as well, where you might see, you know, like a GameSpot or an IGN working with like a Nintendo or Sony to promote a game amongst that. Like, that, those are income streams that these companies are losing.
You mentioned IGN, which is interesting because IGN have kind of announced a replacement for E3 this year. They've announced their Summer of Gaming event, and I don't know if this was planned to happen regardless of E3, or if they very, very quickly, after the cancellation of E3, decided to implement their own idea, but they were quite quick on getting on board with this. And I'll quote them here. Apparently, Summer of Games, which is taking place in June, so at the same time E3 was supposed to take place, it's a global digital event set to begin this June to bring you the latest news and impressions around upcoming games and the next generation of console hardware. IGN will be collaborating with a number of partners for the Summer of Gaming, including 2K, Square Enix, Sega, Bandai Namco, Amazon, Google Stadia, Twitter, Devolver Digital, THQ Nordic, and more. Expect more details in the coming weeks. Like, it seems like they're already on board, and this ball is already rolling, and they're kind of planning a digital E3 with a lot of these big publishers on board and console manufacturers. They've already said that there's going to be details on the next set of console generations, so they've clearly got Xbox and PlayStation on board too.
Do they? I feel like the Nintendo and... So, in that sort of post that IGN made, they did list quite a number of partners, they said.
Yeah.
In that list specifically, I cannot see Nintendo,
I can't
Xbox,
see them either,
or PlayStation. So,
but when
I
they
think
say
that...
specifically upcoming games and the next generation of console hardware, unless they're talking about freaking Google Stadia as the next generation of console hardware, I assume they've got something.
Well, I mean, I imagine that a lot of that would be around the game set to release on next gen, right?
Right. Like,
we're going to probably see quite a lot of game releases that could be exclusive to next gen, or that might really suffer, not suffer, that sounds really dramatic, but basically, like, you want to be able to play this on Xbox Series X, on PlayStation 5, and so that would be where they're like, we're bringing you the next generation, right? Whereas Sony, Nintendo, Xbox, they're all in a position where they have their own platforms, they have their own events that they can run completely separately digitally. Nintendo has a Nintendo Direct, PlayStation has a State of Play, and then Xbox XO20 would be what it was called this year.
Yeah.
Like, they have their own platforms up. And so I don't think that IGN necessarily needs to host everything.
No, it'd be weird if they did, to be honest. Yeah. Like, that's too much power to one media organization.
Well, I mean, they are the media organization that a lot of people would be looking towards this time of year anyway, right?
Yeah.
So it makes sense as to why 2K, Squeenix, Sega, Bandai Namco, like all of these companies that would otherwise already be in talks with IGN about media, like appointments, around potentially running some PR, around advertising. It makes sense for them to reach out to IGN and say, hey, would you be comfortable, or would you be able to, like, be able to give us a platform to be able to get out there? And because so many have basically bought into this and say, hey, we want to get involved, this makes it an event, right? Like, a digital event, not just one. Like, I don't think anyone really, I mean, some people care about 2K games, but 2K having their own live stream isn't going to pull mad numbers. It's not going to pull mad traffic and really play into a broader marketing campaign. Whereas having all of these developers and publishers here, I think that will bring a lot more attention to a digital event that otherwise might be forgotten by a lot of people, especially those in the mainstream media.
Yeah, and hopefully they also partner up with some of the smaller guys too. As you mentioned earlier, the indies are kind of the biggest people missing out on an E3 not taking place. So hopefully if IGN can put a spotlight on some of those awesome upcoming indie games as well, then that might help to subdue some of the pain from losing your spot on the E3 stage. Now, I guess we better start wrapping this up. What do you think, Jack, of an online-only future for E3 or for all of these kind of events?
I don't think that's realistic. Like, the reality of the current situation is that we need to be online. Like, we are online-only by necessity. In a year, 2 years' time, 3 years' time, that more than likely won't be the case. And so we might see an increase in digital events. We might see a potentially more smaller publishers potentially running their own digital events. And like in the vein of a Nintendo Direct or a State of Play, right? This could be an exercise where some smaller players actually gain some footing, where otherwise all of the big players really pick up a lot of the media attention. And, you know, good luck to a lot of the indie developers that will be highlighted on Nintendo, PlayStation, and Xbox's streams, because that's still probably going to be happening. It just won't be happening on a big stage in the middle of Los Angeles. I don't think that we're necessarily going to an online-only future, but I think that the importance of online events is set to increase after this, for sure.
Yep. Very true. Well said. Thank you, Jack, and or Cringe. Sorry, it's going to take me a little bit to get used to that.
I'm good either way. Like, I really am not particularly like, oh, you didn't call me by my other name. It's like, I don't care. People can have different names. It's fine.
All right. Thank you for joining me to talk all about E3 2020, the future of E3, and just the ESA in general. We'll catch you guys next week for more intimate goodness.
You've been listening to Checkpoint Intimates. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate and subscribe on iTunes and Stitcher.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.